I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. It's funny, right? The little things that stick out in your memory. Like the stuff that's, why is this even in my head? But then you start to maybe understand why it's in your head years later. Like this moment. I was 18 or 19, I think. I'm home, it's summer, I'm at my parents' house. I have no idea what I'm gonna do in my life, and I am just watching an ungodly amount of TV. And one night, I'm watching people cook on TV, which was kind of weird. This was the mid-90s. But anyway, one of the women on the screen is chopping garlic, and she goes, "Now, you really wanna find some good, fresh garlic. When it's really fresh, it's almost wet when you cut it." And that's it. That random moment has stuck with me forever. But 2 years later, I got my first cooking job, and that changed my life. Okay, so it probably wasn't just because of that garlic moment on TV, but every time I think of Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, the chefs who were cooking on my TV that day, I think about how many people there were like me, sitting in front of their TVs and seeing for the first time these two make cooking seem so fun. Now, Mary Sue and Susan are way more than just TV chefs. They've been in business together for almost 40 years. They opened a quirky little restaurant called City Cafe that helped to redefine the restaurant scene in Los Angeles. Today, they have a wildly popular group of Mexican restaurants called Border Grill, and they're active philanthropists. And this year, they're also the winners of the Julia Child Award. It's given every year at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History by the Julia Child Foundation, and it celebrates the people who've helped to change American food culture. And they're here with me today. So Mary Sue and Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
It's a great moment. Congratulations so much on winning the Julia Child Award. So actually, before I start, did you guys know Julia Child?
Oh my gosh. We knew her so well and loved her so much. This is just a crazy, amazing honor for us.
Yeah, she came into City Cafe the first time, I think, in 1982, and we were just beside ourselves, you know, excited that we were going to be cooking for Julia Child.
Wait, you have to tell how she came. We were in our tiny little kitchen that was like 8 by 10 or 10 by 10 or something like that, and we had, the bathroom was in the kitchen, and there was, you know, we had finally put a stove in the kitchen with an oven, which we hadn't had before. Before, we had just had two hot plates and two hibachis in the parking lot out back. But there was a double-door refrigerator right in front of the bathroom. I think Mary Sue was behind the stove, and there were pots and pans all hanging. And I think I was on the floor cleaning out the refrigerator in front of the bathroom. So that, all of a sudden, we hear someone come in because guests came into the kitchen to go to the bathroom. And someone knocked their head on the pots and pans and said hello in her, you know, voice that you can't not recognize. And there I was with food on the floor. Mary Sue was cooking, and it was her, because we didn't know she was coming in.
No, it was a big surprise. It was so much fun, though. And, you know, she was one of those people who was a big champion of young, up-and-coming women and, you know, anyone who had a passion for food, you know, she just connected to immediately. So it was really fun.
It was amazing. I mean, that was, you know, what year was it, Mill? 82? 82. So that was really, we had just opened our first place. It had been just a year that we'd been open. So it was very new of being, you know, entrepreneurs and young chefs. So to have her come in was really like, okay, you couldn't get any bigger than that. So that was very exciting.
It's like being visited by the Pope, right?
Right.
So now you have this award. And I think the criteria for the award is, quote, people who have made a profound and significant difference in the way America cooks, eats, and drinks. So that seems like a big deal. And it sounds kind of like a Lifetime Achievement Award. So do you feel like you're in the Lifetime Achievement Award phase of your careers?
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that. I think, you know, I think we both take it as the half lifetime achievement award since there's two of us.
And we, you know, we both still act like we're between 16 and 20.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's sort of our secret for how we stay young, because we both, you know, are still so in love with this career. It couldn't have worked out better for either of us.
And and you have, I mean, I think the career keeps you so young, or can, because you also have, you know, kids that are between like 18 and, you know, 30 that are working for you. 30 is even old.
Sure.
Working for us. So, you know, we have so many young kids working with us. And I think that just by its nature keeps you young. And, you know, and I think we're immersed in it with them. And so just the nature of it. And also, all we've also always been very hungry for learning and growing. And even way back when we first started, you know, teaching cooking classes, you know, even though I think we probably knew a fair amount, we would like study every ingredient so we would know every detail or a lot of details about a tomato, an onion, you know, broccoli. And
I think there was a fear that there would be one moment of silence during a cooking class.
Yeah.
So even, and you know, that never happens with us because there's two of us for one, and one of us really talks a lot.
What?
And then
who?
There's you. I think that was really what made us, you know, we did so many cooking classes before our first radio show, Good Food, and that really had prepared us for, you know, finishing each other's sentences and building on each other's thoughts and kind of articulating our philosophy about food out loud. And that is a really important, I think, part of anyone's career, anyone's, you know, profession, because I think it really helps you to, when you're teaching, it helps you to, you know, be grounded in what you really believe.
And, you know, so much, I think, back then was based around the French kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of us, through culinary school and then through working in great restaurants, which were all French restaurants at the time.
And in France, and working in France.
Right. We both worked a year, Mary Sue in Paris and myself in the south of France. And I think that training gave us technique and skills that I think was really the backbone of us being able to then explore other cuisines, or at least that's how it felt to us, is that there was such a great strong background in the French kitchen that then when we were able to explore other cuisines, we were able to take them apart in ways that I don't know that we could have if we didn't have that training.
This is super interesting because I want to get to your cooking. Because I think you're known as, you know, like when I was growing up, I first heard of you through your TV show, Two Hot Tamales. And I was like, oh, okay, they cook
Mexican
food.
Don't act like you're so young, Francis, and we're so old.
So
wow.
When I was in utero, my mom would put the headphones on your show.
Right.
No, when I was, you know, that show was 1995? 93?
Yeah, was it? Yeah, it was right when Food Network began.
But anyway, my point is I thought of you as being chefs who cook Mexican food, and certainly you have Border Grill, which is your family of restaurants. But I want to go back a bit to, say, 1981. You're opening your first restaurant, City Cafe. Like you said, you don't have a stove in the kitchen. You're cooking practically in the parking lot and running the food inside.
No. Not practically. We had two hibachis on the ground in the parking lot where many of the customers park.
But we only use them at night.
Yeah, we only used them at nighttime.
The daytime, it was more sandwiches, salads, soups.
So you're literally cooking in the, you know, it's this very, you know, it sounds like this very buyer bootstraps kind of place. And you gained a following because you weren't cooking French cooking. You were cooking this really internationally inspired food. So it's interesting to hear you had classical French training. What inspired you to start taking in all these other influences? And this was 81, right? So this is not common at the time in quote-unquote chefy restaurants.
Yeah, not at all. It was actually, you know, there was Ma Maison. There, Espago opened in 81 also.
No.
It did.
Oh, Spago opened in 81. That's right.
Yeah. But so there was a little bit of a kind of a thrust towards more, you know, casual but modern and really exciting food with Wolfgang's Spago. But
beyond that, there was Chasen's, you know, Morton's, Valentino.
Not very many restaurants that were pushing the envelope.
Yeah, and L'Orangerie.
We decided to pretty much follow our hearts. You know, we had a tiny restaurant with 8 tables and 9 stools at the bar, and we cooked whatever we loved. But the first couple of years, there was a lot of rustic sort of country French food, because that's what we were drawn to, much more than the nouvelle cuisine and the fancy hot cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, we had, Mary Sue and I had met at Le Perroquet in Chicago, and he was doing very cutting edge dishes then. You know, Jovan Trbojevic was just an amazing restaurateur. So we were doing things like taking whole baby lambs and stuffing those and then poaching all the different components of it. And when we both came back from being in France and we decided to open up our first little place, the menu was made up of things like cassoulet, pot-au-feu, confit à duck. So all country French stuff, really not anything.
But we also did things like pasta salads and you know, sandwiches and things that were very, you know, it was a cafe. It was open from 8 in the morning till 10 at night. So it wasn't anything like, you know, any of the fancy restaurants we'd been trained in. So we had to also kind of dig and figure out, well, what, let's make Susan's mother's coleslaw or her pickles, or let's make, you know, German potato salad that my mom made. And we would do that. But then after about 2 years, neither of us had had a break more than one day a week for ages. And Susan decided that she was going to take a trip and go to India. And I'll never forget it. The night before she left, we were having a little kind of like a fake fight.
We were racing. We were racing to see who could bone a leg of lamb quicker.
And that is a cliffhanger. We'll be back with more from Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger on who won that fight and how they went from cooking French food to pretty much anything else. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking to Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, this year's winners of the Julia Child Award. And when we last left our heroines, they were telling us about the first years of their seminal LA restaurant, City Cafe, where they cooked French food literally in the parking lot because they didn't have a kitchen big enough. And then how they got into a figurative knife fight the night before Susan would take a trip that would change both their careers. Now we're going to back this tape up so you can hear it again.
After about 2 years, neither of us had had a break more than one day a week for ages. And Susan decided that she was going to take a trip and go to India. And I'll never forget it. The night before she left, we were having a little kind of like a fake fight.
We were racing. We were racing to see who could bone a leg of lamb quicker.
And then, that's how your fights work out? Like,
yeah, I think I won.
She did win because I like threw my arm up in the air as in a gesture, and she had her knife in the air, and I cut the tendon in my finger. So I had to go to the hospital and get a cast, and she was like, God. Oh, maybe I can't go. And I said, no, you got to go. You got to go. And so then there was me and Jose Luis, and we were cooking everything for those 2 weeks while she was gone. But what happened is when she came home, she was gung-ho to put about, you know, 4 or 5 Indian dishes on the menu. We did pakoras, like little vegetable fritters. We did a puna pancake. We made dal and curry and did
chutney and raita. And
it was really like immediately we just incorporated it into the menu. So it was all these rustic French things and a bunch of Indian things.
Yeah. So that and I had been so inspired over there by all the flavor profiles and just it was such an interesting cuisine. All vegetarian was the place where I was staying on an ashram where a friend of mine lived. So I spent the whole time in the kitchen with his cooks. And although women were, you know, not allowed in the main little kitchen, that basically were just 3 holes in a cement block that, you know, you put a fire underneath it. But all the women were out on the porch grinding spices, making all the different breads. And it was so inspiring that it just was something I felt like we have to put these things on the menu. Mm. And then about a year later, Mary Sue took her first trip. She didn't cut me right before she left, but she took her first trip then to Thailand and had a very similar experience.
Yeah, my uncle was there and he lined it up so I could work in the kitchen of the hotel where he was, and it had a big, very, very authentic Thai buffet. And the woman who cooked it was actually the cook for the King and Queen of Thailand for 10 years before that.
Oh, wow.
And she didn't speak any English and I didn't speak any Thai, but, you know, we got along immediately and we cooked together all day, every day for 3 weeks. And then same thing, I came home and we were, you know, Thai melon salad and Chinese sausage salad and Thai red curry duck and scallops. And oh my gosh, we have pictures that are just amazing.
And so then, you know, then our menu then had cassoulet and then duck red curry and then potato bhajia with mint cilantro chutney and then, you know, pot-au-feu. And so it was very mixed like that.
And then one day the rigatoni that we bought from a person who made fresh pasta and delivered it came and it was like 3 or 4 inches long instead of the normal inch and a half. And we were like, what happened? They said, oh, we had a problem with the cutter and blah, 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 blah. And then I, you know, this is how Susan and I kind of work together. We're in the kitchen going, oh, you remember those chicken breasts? We've got to use them today no matter what. We can't let them go another day. Okay, well, let's make a sausage out of that chicken breast with a lot of fennel and we'll stuff it into the rigatoni. And then, I don't know, what do you think? Well, let's just try it with cream and Parmesan. And anyway, that rigatoni became like a signature dish that everybody ordered. And so we had to tell the pasta company, can you make our rigatoni long all the time?
And literally, it became one of those favorite dishes. And some of the inspiration comes that way of trying to like get rid of things that we think we need to get rid of. And other inspiration comes from people that work for us, that someone whose mother made something when they were growing up in a tiny town in Mexico, like our mushroom empanadas.
Or you see something in the market. I mean, when we first decided to turn City Cafe into a little tiny Mexican restaurant called Border Grill, we went to Mexico for 3 weeks. We drove around in a little tiny VW bug and we, you know, asked a trillion questions of everybody we could find. But if we'd go to the market and see something we'd never seen before, we would buy it. And then we would take it and ask people what it is. How do you use it? What's this chili? I remember we discovered Chipotle chilies and nobody knew what a Chipotle was, more or less a chain of restaurants. It was 1985.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we didn't, you know, that first trip to Mexico, we stayed. Well, our little kitchen at City Cafe was myself and Mary Sue and a dishwasher. But then eventually we hired like a culinary student who came in, you know, probably wanted like $18 an hour. We said, no, 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 we'll hire you for like $5 an hour, whatever it was at that time.
Whatever minimum wage was. And so, he said, okay.
So he came to work for us. His name was Tacho, and we loved him. And we ended up going to Mexico City and staying with his parents in their home. And his mom took us every day for a few days to the market. This was our first trip, and we like bought everything that we didn't know what it was and come home and cook with her all day. So it was how we started to learn about Mexican ingredients. And we fell in love with this cuisine. And then we did this driving around where we just like ate everything. We wrote our first menu in the Volkswagen Bug. When we came back, we opened up. And when we opened up with this, you know, Mexican menu, and literally we had to take our notebook out, like with the panuchos or with the gorditas. We couldn't remember what they even were, you know, called. And so we were constantly looking at our notebook. But that was sort of the beginning of Border Grill. That was the beginning.
Wow. Again, I keep thinking about the time frame. This is in the early to mid 80s. This is not stuff that was happening in chefy restaurants. And, you know, people starting today have such a different frame of reference than that. And I think they probably grew up with, you know, their favorite Thai restaurant that they went to, you know, with their family and their favorite Mexican place that they went to and all that stuff. So all that stuff is already built into so many American palates as they're growing up now.
Right. You know, when we opened City, so the bigger version, when we opened City Restaurant, and it was then food that was influenced from cities all around the world, we put a tandoori oven in, and we got that tandoori oven from a owner of a hotel. He was an Indian man. We went downtown in a pickup truck, and picked up this unfired tandoori oven. So it's just raw clay that's been dried, and it's like held together with elephant hair. And we brought it back in the back of a pickup truck, hoping we wouldn't hit too big a bump so that it would crack. And then we learned all about how to fire it. And then we spent one day, like 14 hours, where you have to bring it up to like 1,200 degrees. We wrapped our bodies so we could stick our arms in there, because you had to keep brushing the sides with a brown sugar and mustard oil in order to glaze it. We played Indian music and incense. And then finally, you know, the night before our opening party, and Ruth Reichel was there that night, and Wolf, we made that night, like at 3 a.m, we finally made our first batch of naan. And you can't even, it looked like a dirty sock when we pulled it out of the oven.
Well, interestingly, you talk about how different it is these days for young cooks. I mean, we had never gone through an opening.
Right.
We didn't know what that meant. You know, an opening, it was just completely seat of the pants, like, and we were dead out of money. We had to open because we needed some cash. We couldn't even buy groceries. So we had been in the kitchen with our health department, the okay, for about maybe 48 hours when we opened the doors and we were flooded with people. And we were the only two people who knew how to cook the food.
Oh. And that very first night, our hood, you know, we had to go through all getting the approvals of the tandoori oven because no one even knew how to give it approval. We finally got it approved. So we opened the door and the hoods went out that first night. And so it was crazy hot on the line. I almost passed out and we were jammed. And right, Mary Sue and I were the only two that were like running from station to station.
I'm so happy we know now what we know, because, you know, that opening was pretty brutal. But, you know, I think also what's different is we were two young women, and I think subconsciously we felt like, yeah, we could go work for some more French guys or work in French kitchens here and, you know, really work our way up. But how long would it take us to call the shots for our own business? Neither of us, I think, were very excited about working for someone. It seemed like a better gamble to, even if you had to go super small like we did, to open and be our own bosses.
Okay, so a number of years after that, you know, get a call to go on the Food Network. What was that like? Because that was a new frontier.
Yeah, it was. We had gotten called to come and do Chef for a Day, I think. It was a 5-day stint to come on and do it.
Well, you taped 5 shows in one day.
Well, that was normal. That was actually less than when we started Two Hot Tamales.
And then, you know, we went and we did our 5 shows and we had a really good time. We were just joking around all day. And, you know, by this time we were pretty comfortable. We'd already had our radio show for 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was definitely kind of, you know, I think teaching a lot of classes prepared us for radio. The radio prepared us for television. Radio is harder, in my opinion, than TV because you don't have the visual. You have to really create something, you know, that people can conjure up in their minds. But I think that they immediately thought to themselves, because they came back to us like literally the next week and said, would you do 60 Mexican-inspired TV shows called Cooking South of the Border, cha-cha-cha, or whatever.
Yeah, they're like, no, we'll do the TV shows, but we're not going to call it that.
So I think it was your mother who came up with Two Hot Tamales.
Maybe. We kept coming up with different names, but we came up with Two Hot Tamales, and they went for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, we were both, I think, because, like Mary Sue said, we were so comfortable with information because it was so much a part of our everyday life because we always thought of ourselves as teachers to the people that work for us, that we just did the same thing and we were just ourselves. So we weren't nervous in front of the camera. So that was really made TV very easy for us. We treated it as though we were teaching a class, you know, with 50 people in front of us.
And in those days, you know, Reese Schoenfeld and his wife, they had sort of started the network based on, he had started CNN, and his idea was that every bit of programming ought to be fresh. So, you know, it's food every day. You shoot something, you play it, and then that's it. You don't play it again, or you play it 3 times a day at different times. And it was just very, you know, it was the wild, wild west. They didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah, we shot 6 shows a day 5 days a week. So in 1 week, we shot 30 shows.
And then we went and prepared all the recipes and everything. And so that was a big, a lot of pre-production work that we would do. We'd get the recipes together, the talking notes, you know, things that we wanted to make sure we didn't forget to let our audience know. And then we'd come back like a month later and do another 30 shows.
Wow.
But they were quick, though. You know, they'd roll camera, and then they wouldn't say cut until you were 25 minutes in, and then they never edited it at all.
Right. I mean, they would say, you know, they would be showing us like the countdown, cut, cut, and I think we sort of ignored it a lot of the time.
Susan always ignored it.
I ignored it, and then it was like, okay, we got to go. So it was...
The chicken's still raw, but see you next time.
Yeah. It was pretty fun, and we almost thought we were on vacation because we were used to working, you know, from 7 in the morning till 11 at night, you know, 6 days a week.
Yeah, and in the studio, we'd be getting off, start at 7 and get off at 6.
And we'd be like, oh, my God, we've got the whole night to go out in New York and eat and drink. And yeah.
But, right. Okay, so, like, 4 years, I think the show ran, Two Hot Tamales ran, so, and then were hundreds and hundreds of episodes. You've had many restaurants through the years, and Susan, you actually had restaurants apart from Mary Sue as well, but together you've been a business partnership for 38 years?
Is it eight?
I think so.
Is it eight now? 38?
Yeah, I'm like 5 years into my marriage. It feels like it's the only thing I've ever known. Like, how have you kept it together? And did it feel like you were inevitably going to be together for 38 years plus?
I think it did for me anyway. It was when I met Susan, we were the only two women. I was the first and she was the second at Le Perroquet. And I had never met anyone that I was so comfortable with just to cook with. It was just really very automatic and easy. But then, you know, she went her way and I went my way and I didn't really think about it, or there was no conscious decision. But after kind of keeping in touch when we ended up in France around the same time, kind of serendipitously, that was when we had a couple bottles of wine and looked out the window and there was a rainbow. And we said, okay, let's open a restaurant together. And, you know, I remember, I got to find that notebook because it had things that had like names of restaurants like Mademoiselles. Really goofy. Like, we didn't have any money or anything. But then, you know, I think over the years, it's been a real, sometimes, challenge and a real joy. I think the times that I appreciate Susan the most is when we've gone through a failure or we're failing, because failing together is so much more fun than failing by yourself. You can imagine. And of course, there's plenty of ups and downs. And we've always, I think, been really sensitive to each other's needs. You know, I've got two kids and Susan's, you know, got her partner of a long time, but basically, you know, we're different people and we have different needs. So it can't always be the same. It has to change. Our partnership has to change.
And I think we both, probably through each of our individual therapy, you know, took responsibility for, you know, where we were at in our lives and what we wanted. And I think that helped because we were willing to be flexible. So we allowed that openness to happen. And so I think that's what helped us be able to stay great partners. And there's something so amazing about having a partner who you trust impeccably. You know, it doesn't mean we don't disagree or that we're always on the same page, because we definitely aren't.
And sometimes we might not even completely trust each other. I know you think we do. But there's times when...
This is brand new, Francis. Thank you for being our therapist.
When we argue about things, it's definitely like, you know, I don't trust that point of view.
Anyway, oh, yeah. You know. I think there's things like, I know that no matter what, like if something were to go down, that we would both be there to take care of it. You know, we pull together in a really strong way.
And we must have, you know, intuitively known that our skill sets were different enough that we would complement each other a lot and be able to kind of fill in the blanks, which is a good thing and a bad thing because, you know, I never really have had to develop certain skills because Susan would always take care of that. Like, you know, coddling and babysitting the employees. I didn't have to do that. But, you know, so I, I think as we've matured, we've both gotten better at doing what the other does also, to just become more of a well-rounded sort of individual.
Yeah.
Because I think in the beginning we were very, you know, we had real separate, I love pastries, I like order, I like things to work, I like things to happen and flow in the way that they should. Susan adores the hotline, the chaos. She loves a problem. She loves everything falling apart. So it's just, you know, we're lucky that we have those complementary skill sets.
Yeah. It's like you're, this is such a cheesy analogy. I'm going to hate myself for saying this, but like you're like the steel for each other's knives. You do different things, but you sharpen each other. What a gift to have this partnership, this friendship. And congratulations.
That's not cheesy. I like that.
Yeah.
The steel for each other's knives. I think that's brilliant.
That's all I kept thinking of when you kept saying like, oh, like we're different, but we have to learn to do each other's things. And I just think like, oh, you sharpen yourselves against one another. And I think that's such a key to a creative partnership.
Yeah.
So congratulations again on the award, on 38 years together in business. May it be many, many more. And it was great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here, Francis.
We'll have to get back together with you on the next Half Lifetime Achievement Award if we get that again.
You're the best.
Terrific. Thank you guys so much.
All right. Thanks.
That was the duo of Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, the 2018 winners of the Julia Child Award. And coming up,
they had gone through their stuff ahead of time and had pulled out just boxes and bags and piles of things. And, you know, to a curator, that's just catnip.
That's Paula Johnson, a curator from the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, talking about what it's like to get the stuff that goes into the museum's food collection. Stick around. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So, the Julia Child Awards are given every year at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. And part of the deal is that the winners all donate objects from their lives that help tell the story of their careers. So their stuff actually goes into the museum's collections to be immortalized forever. Paula Johnson is a curator at the museum, and she joins us to talk about how she gets the good stuff. Hey, Paula, great to have you here.
Hi, Francis.
So you have a very cool part of your job, and that is that you get to go to all the winners of the Julia Child Award and bring back something from them to display in the museum. So I want to know what's that like? I mean, what's that like standing in front of someone who's going through their stuff and you know they're thinking, oh man, I'm going to be in the Smithsonian forever.
Yeah, it is a cool part of my job. I will admit that. It has been different for each of the winners, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for Jacques Pepin, it was something that we talked about, and then it led from one thing to another. For Rick Bayless, it was also very different. I was able to speak with him and his staff and to really talk about it quite a lot ahead of time. And by the time they came back with a very wonderful list, I pretty much knew that there were certain things that stood out. Jacques Pepin donated a collection of menus, and as you probably know, he is an artist, and these menus are works of art and show both, of course, the menu items, but also his whimsy, as well as photographs and documents and a few kitchen tools. From Rick Bayless, we were able to collect his original field notes from his research in Mexico in the 1970s. They are just fantastic because he was an anthropologist and was keeping incredible notes as he traveled around different regions of Mexico. And the field notes are handwritten, and then midway through, they are typed. And he realized that he really wanted to type his notes halfway through the trip, so he bought a little typewriter, and he donated the typewriter as well.
Oh, cool.
From Danny Meyer, we collected around his concept of enlightened hospitality that really shaped and drove his groundbreaking restaurants in New York. So we have, again, another document, this notebook of his conversations with people that he was asking for guidance developing Union Square. It's quite a diverse collection, as you can see. We're really looking at, again, the biographies of people and their particular stories. This year, it's wonderful to have been able to go to Los Angeles and to speak with Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger about their, you know, their stuff. But we don't really start with the stuff. We always start with the story of who they are and how they got to where they are, how they got into the restaurant business, and what those early years were like, what the struggles may have been, what were the challenges, and how did they land on, you know, this very successful formula that they have. So for me, it really starts with the story of learning about who the people are, what the big themes might be in their histories, and then to show up and talk to them about what that might look like. What is the kind of the kernel of their own history? So I was delighted to be able to go to Los Angeles at the end of July and to meet them in Border Grill. They had gone through their stuff ahead of time and had pulled out just boxes and bags and piles of things. And, you know, to a curator, that's just, you know, that's catnip going in and looking at that. And they had a pretty good sense of, you know, what we were after and had come up with some great material.
So what is it? What is it that they're donating? You have me in so much suspense right now.
Okay, that's where we want you. We are in the middle of collecting this material. Two big boxes arrived a few weeks ago. And in one box was Mary Sue Milliken's knife bag that she had packed for competing on Top Chef Masters, which she did in 2011. And, you know, this is an object that we don't have anything quite like it in the collections yet. And there it all was, you know, all beautifully arranged. There are six knives, four spatulas, you know, chopsticks, scissors, zesters, you know, all of this stuff.
Oh, man.
So very, very cool.
And what about Susan? What is Susan donating?
Yes, well, the two of them have also donated some of the dishes from their early restaurant, City Cafe, in Los Angeles. And these are just so special. They're beautiful, very colorful, and they are shapes that reflect the cuisine that they were really featuring in City Cafe. And so we have a nice 8 or 10 pieces. And to come to the museum, we will have a chef's coat. You know, Mary Sue and Susan were very into color very early on. And so we have a pink chef's coat with Border Grill embroidered on the cuff, which again shows how they're very cognizant of the fact when they are doing something on television that they can also show their Border Grill or the camera angle, which is wonderful. And then we've got, you know, the archives are always, you know, very, very interesting to go through. I mean, there's paper and then there's paper. And for us, there were these little notebooks that didn't look like much. But of course, when you pick them up and you look at them and you realize, oh, my gosh, this is their first trip to Mexico, you know, trying to really research some of the culinary roots of dishes that they were interested in for their restaurants.
Yeah.
So little notebooks like that. Another one from India and from Thailand.
Oh, so cool.
And, you know, this is where you can sort of imagine as a researcher looking through this and sort of seeing the thought process of somebody who is curious about food traditions in other parts of the world and cooks and people in other parts of the world and to then think about bringing that back for their restaurant in Los Angeles.
Yeah. It's so cool, too, because I imagine, you know, if you fast forward 20 years in the future now, 30 years in the, you know, the people who are going to win it then, you're going to be like, hey, can you send me the text that you were texting to yourself from that, you know, when you visit the tortilla factory? But let me ask you, what you're also doing, though, is you're going through essentially someone, like, as you said, someone's life story through the objects that they have held and written in. And is it an emotional process for them?
It is, kind of. And in fact, you will see people bring this stuff out and then it's there. And then when we come and we start handling it, gently of course, but handling it and talking to them about it, you know, the stories are triggered. And when they start telling the story, the meaning is made apparent of what this object represents to them and their lives and what they care about. And there are these emotional moments when somebody will, you know, have that look on their face. And we always tell people, look, you know, it's your choice to donate something to the collections. And if you're not ready, you're not ready. So we don't force people. But those emotional stories are the things that we document along with collecting the actual objects and that we try to preserve as well so that it can be conveyed and communicated to a larger audience.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Paula. This is so interesting.
Thanks, Francis. My pleasure.
That's Paula Johnson, a curator at the National Museum of American History and the director of the American Food and Wine History Project. And fun fact, Paula Johnson is also one of the curators responsible for one of the most amazing exhibits at the Smithsonian, Julia Child's kitchen. I mean, literally her entire kitchen lives in the museum. Every counter, every knife, every gadget. So I thought that was super cool, but for Lisa McManus, who leads the equipment testing in America's Test Kitchen, it's like Valhalla. She talked with Sally Swift about Julia's way with tools.
Hello, Miss McManus.
Hi, Sally.
We have you here for a reason, because we have been skirting around Julia Child this hour, talking to the winners of this year's Julia Child Award, Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger. And I wanted to talk to you because you have an interesting sweet spot for Julia Child. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Julia was a gadget freak. She described herself as a gadget
she
freak.
She was.
Yes. And I've made a couple pilgrimages to her exhibit, the exhibit of her kitchen at the Smithsonian. And literally, they for me were pilgrimages. And I was standing there, you know, craning my neck and jumping up and down and trying to see every corner. And I can at this point look at photos of her from way back and, you know, when she was in Paris or look in that kitchen. And I, at this point, know the brand of each product. And I just keep gathering so much information about what she chose to have around her, what she bought over the years, what she really used. And to me, that's just, I just geek out.
The idea of you being able to look at this old photograph and going, is that a Sabatier knife I'm seeing hanging there?
Exactly.
It's pretty
exactly.
great. So tell me, give me some specifics about her relationship to equipment and what you think was so brilliant.
Well, you know, Julia really was, I call her Julia like she was my friend. I never met her, but everyone feels they know her. She has such a personality. But she came to cooking late, as everybody knows the story. I mean, she discovered food pretty late in life and, you know, fell in love with cuisine and really the tradition of France and learned from the Cordon Bleu and everything. But then her impulse was to teach other people, you know, to bring them up to this level where they could see what she saw and to bring it down to a point, not dumbing it down, but making it familiar, making it comfortable to cook beautiful, delicious food at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, she took professional equipment that she saw French chefs using. And she went to restaurant supply stores way back when, way before that was cool.
Right.
And she translated that for home cooks. And she would really try to show people, you can do this too. And I'm just so inspired by that. But I also, you know, I look around and I'll start researching a story. I'm like, you know, carbon steel pans, chefs use them. People really weren't using them at home. And I'm looking at pictures of her kitchen and look, there's a bunch of them. I can recognize them. She had them. And even though she later embraced nonstick pans, she never gave up on those carbon steel pans. She kept them.
And all that copper that she
used. Beautiful copper pans in every size. What wouldn't I give to have her kitchen and all that stuff to play with? And I think everybody feels that way when they see that. That kitchen, if you ever see it, totally packed wall to wall. Mm-hmm. Every inch is full. Everything's at hand. I mean, she had that pegboard on the wall that Paul Child, her husband, always designed for her from their earliest kitchen in Paris. That pegboard that he'd put up on the walls, paint it, stick her pans, draw a big black outline of each pan and each thing, you know, fish molds and things, and put the hook up and hang those pans so that you could grab them and use them. It wasn't about displaying them. It was about being able to grab them, use them, put them back. And I just love that.
It was a workshop.
Yeah, and I often think of kitchen tools that way, you know.
Yeah, and speaking of tools, I want to get to her knives because she was a massive knife lover, and she introduced us all to those magnetic strips.
Yes, yes. If you go to see her kitchen, there's between the windows in the kitchen over the sink or countertop, there's a magnetic knife strip, a couple of them. And she does an unusual thing that I've never really seen anyone else do, which is that she put them vertically up and down between the windows and then sticks the knives across horizontally, you know, and she has them kind of range from big to small. And, you know, that's kind of brilliant. It uses some dead space that no one ever really uses. People always think that you're supposed to hang those things horizontally and put the knives upright. You know, why not do this kind of quirky, that was Julia all the way, you know, take something that's classical, but use it in her own twisted, you know, like she'll find a twist that makes it more functional.
She would have loved you saying in her own twisted way, I'm quite certain.
I started to say that, and I realized I didn't really mean it that way.
So, and what about the Cuisinart? What do you know about Julia and the Cuisinart? Because for me, it seems like she was the original poster child, right?
She really was. She got her hands on a Robocoupe, which is the French company whose design was brought to America by Cuisinart and sold as, you know, the first food processors in the early 1970s. She got her hands on one and really said, this is it. This is the greatest thing. I mean, she was into tradition, but also into, you know, making it modern, making it more doable for home cooks. And, you know, one of the things she kept talking about was fish mousse, that you take fish and you pound it in the mortar and pestle for hours and you put it through this sieve and, you know, to get this silky texture consistency. And she said, you can do it in a few seconds in a food processor. And now everyone will be making fish mousse. And I'm like, she's not right about everything.
That didn't quite catch on.
No, but, you know, the rest of it was true. It certainly sped up a lot of cooking for people. People fell in love with it because she talked about it all the time and she used it.
And she had issues with the Cuisinart.
Yeah. I tested food processors. One of the things that always annoyed me about the Cuisinart is it has this little safety feature on the food pusher, the thing that pushes the food down the chute.
So that your fingers don't go down the chute, I just want to
point out. Right, it's got a little metal bar that goes from this pushing device and has to engage with the base in order for the machine to go. And that's, of course, smart, but it means you have to cut food down to fit in the chute. She famously, one of her producers, Jeff Drummond, who also used to produce our show way back in the day, told me this story about her, and he said in front of Cuisinart executives who were watching a demonstration, she was using a Cuisinart, and she said, oh, this silly thing, I just stick a knife in there to make it go so I can leave it open. And she did not care that they were standing there, apparently.
Bypass all safety concerns.
Yeah, I wasn't that brave, but boy, I sure felt it. I was like, yeah, that thing is annoying, but, you know, safety, I guess. I get it.
I love it.
She went her own way.
She did go her own way, as do you. Keep up with the equipment testing.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus is America's Test Kitchen's gadget expert. And in Julia's honor, check out their recipe for tarte de tan. It's on our website, splendidtable.org. Oh, one more thing. Our friends at America's Test Kitchen have a new podcast. It's called Proof, and it's all about those tiny food questions that you just can't get out of your head. It's hosted by Bridget Lancaster, and check it out wherever you get your podcasts. And that is our show for the week. I'm going to give a hand one more time to Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken. You know, before we actually started recording, I could hear them settling into their studio in LA, and they were just giggling and making each other laugh, and it's awesome, right? To have such a friendship and to have such a partnership that's lasted for 40 years and for them to still be doing their thing. It's terrific. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you, as always, to everyone who contributes and makes this show possible. We literally cannot do it without you. So to help support our show, please go to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcasts. Special thanks to our friends at the Smithsonian, Johnny Gibbons, Paula Johnson, and Valeska Hilbig. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.